Hey, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Lowy Institute. My name is Leon Berkelmans. I am the Director of the International Economy Program here at the Lowy Institute. I'd just like to congratulate you all for making it here despite the weather. We were looking out at the weather about an hour ago. It looked horrible, so well done to you all. Today we are delighted to host Chris Heathcote, the CEO of the Global Infrastructure Hub. He will be discussing the hub and what it means for global infrastructure with research fellow and a project manager, Tristram Sagesbury. The hub was an outcome of the 2014 Australian presidency, I'm sure you all remember that, and is the first multilateral institution to be based here in Sydney. The Lowy Institute has hosted a G20 study centre for the past 4 years with support from the Australian government. This event is one of a series of events we are hosting as the G20 Study Centre comes to the end of its natural life. As part of the wrap-up, we are hosting a debate on Australia's international economic engagement on the Institute's digital magazine, The Interpreter. We've already had contributions by Glenn Stevens and Joe Hockey to that, so I encourage you to have a look, and there'll be other exciting contributions to come. Now to introduce our two speakers. Chris has a long career in infrastructure in both the public and private sector. He was a founding partner of Hyder Infrastructure Investors and worked overseas at Macquarie Infrastructure and Real Assets in the UK. He has direct experience with major infrastructure projects in the United States, Europe, Turkey, China, the Ivory Coast, and Australia. Tristram Sagesbury has been a research fellow at the Institute for the last 2 years. He previously worked at the Australian Treasury and is a visiting scholar at Renmin University in Beijing and the Kiel Institute for the World Economy in Germany. So without further ado, I'll pass it over to our speakers.
All right. Thank you very much, Leon, and thank you everyone for braving not only the rain but Sydney's transport infrastructure to get here. Let's kick off with, I think, just jump straight into the first question. And Chris, I'd like to make it a definitional one.
Okay.
What exactly is the hub?
The hub, in its simplest form, is a private sector entity based in Australia. That's the simplest form. It is, in fact, an NGO. It is financed by 8 of the G20 countries and a couple of other countries. It is an information entity, primarily, and it has 5 main aims. The first one is to create a global network of knowledge, which is available freely to anyone who wants to use it. The second area is to understand the data that's surrounding the infrastructure markets and to fill the data gaps, which are important. The third is to provide standard products when necessary. The fourth is to work with governments to improve their capabilities. And the fifth is to create a global project pipeline. But we're slightly more than just information as well, because the overarching aim of the hub is to create more financeable infrastructure projects. And to do that, you need not only to be an information producing and presenting organisation, you also need to be working out what are the levers that change the markets. And these are huge, long-term, slow-moving markets. So what are those big levers and what do you need to do to them to change the countries that need most help? And which are those countries?
This actually jumps straight into, I think, the next area, which is investment has actually fallen as a share of GDP across G20 countries. And it's done that since the global financial crisis. At the same time, there's a lot of rhetoric about needing to boost infrastructure investment. It's the case in Australia, but it's not just for us.
No.
So I suppose the question is, what can we do? Is this simply about a case of throwing more money at projects?
I think the first thing to understand is why that dynamic happened. We got through to the GFC, and the period up to the GFC, there was strong global growth. We were seeing very strong numbers out of China, but we were also seeing strong numbers in Europe, strong numbers in the US, and that was driving a very significant flow of money into the infrastructure space. There was a recognition at the time, or a feeling at the time, that infrastructure was a strategic win. And so countries were very focused on their own infrastructure. In the UK, they were pumping vast amounts of money into the infrastructure space. You were seeing the same in Germany and a number of other countries. US was trying, but maybe not doing as well as others, but that's to do with their federal system. When we hit the GFC, the response to the GFC was a desire to turn back the levels of indebtedness in countries. And in doing that, you need to save money. And there are two ways to save money as government. One is you do the hard yards, you cut back your ongoing expenditure, you reduce the size of government, you become more effective and more efficient, and you use structural reform within government. That's really hard. The other is you look at all of your projects out there and you start chopping them. And that's what happened. Countries cut back on what they saw as discretionary capital spend, and all of it went. And so we saw, and we see, a pretty significant fall in proportion of GDP. Here, I would say actually that the level of spend as a percentage of GDP was very high before the GFC and remains very high compared to other countries post the GFC. So here it's 5-6%, whereas you look at the average, it's probably closer to 2% of GDP. So there is still quite a lot of work being done here. The question you actually ask on the back of that is, what can we do? And what's happened is there's been a really significant change in the way countries, certainly in the G20, but more broadly than that, look at infrastructure. They've gone from saying, infrastructure, it's our strategic advantage. We will, you know, make sure our infrastructure is perfect and protect that position, to recognising that unless we start to drive consumer growth more broadly, then the global economy, which is the only thing that really matters, will stagnate. And it's that stagnation that the G20 is so focused on. And their recognition is that if they can find a way to drive growth into places like Indonesia, 260 million potential consumers or providers, if they can open up those markets, then that will be good for everyone's positions. And that's quite a refreshing view. What can we do? Well, there is a limit to what we can do, because the first stage for any government looking to work with the private sector to create their infrastructure is a desire and a clearly expressed desire to do so. If you look at the countries that are succeeding, the emerging market countries that are succeeding, Jordan, Colombia, Philippines, they start by understanding what it is they want to achieve. Then they understand what the private sector can and can't do. And then they start putting in place the government structures that are important to achieve those aims. If you don't follow that process, and many countries don't, they say, here's my marquee project, I'm going to go and do this project. That's a really painful way of trying to move forwards, because the private sector say, you know, why would I go there for that? There's no flow of projects, there's no obvious backing behind this. I'm going to spend a lot of money and a lot of time and get nowhere. And the one project is often an unachievable stretch anyway.
All right. As someone who lives and breathes G20,
I feel damned by that comment.
I am particularly interested in the hub's origins. The hub is actually a pretty special case for the G20. It's not a body that is in the habit of creating new institutions. In fact, it would have been a phenomenal effort of negotiation to actually convince the hardened negotiators around the G20 table in the first instance that this Australian idea from 2014 was worth them backing. And so I suppose the question is, why do you think the G20 created the hub? What in particular do you think it was that would have been the defining argument?
So I think you need to consider what the G20 is for. And I look at that as falling into two categories. I look at it as the stated aims of the G20 in terms of acting as an economic body, promoting economic discussions, through to the way it actually acts. And the way it actually acts is as a way of interested parties from diverse countries getting together with an excuse to sit and talk away from the more fevered concerns. Does that matter? Well, I'm not going to pretend that the G20 is going to prevent global conflict. That's not the case. But what it does do is it ensures that countries are discussing things. Come the GFC, the G20 showed the value of having an ability to sit down and talk about difficult areas in an environment which allows a freer flow of conversation. There are plenty of downsides of the G20. There are plenty of ways in which it is inefficient and ineffective and could be better. But that basic requirement and that two-tier set of deliverables is, I believe, quite important. In fact, I think it's very important. The reason they backed the hub is because they were sitting looking at what looked like to them a crisis, and a crisis not on the scale of the financial meltdowns of the markets, which had led to the creation of the Financial Stability Board, the FSB, but a crisis of stagnation and lack of growth, and the impact that that would have on the countries that are trying to emerge and become the developed countries of the future. And there was a recognition that without some growth target, without the G20 focusing its economic nous on trying to make growth more universal, then they would never get to the point where countries saw themselves as having a future and moving up that pecking order from being a low GDP country to a mid GDP country. Creation of the middle classes, which we've seen so effectively in China, and to follow that string. So G20 looked at it and they said, fiscal levers, they're gone. I mean, we're still seeing a little bit of fiscal lever being marked here, but interestingly enough, it looked to me as if the Aussie currency increased in strength on the reduction of the interest rate, which makes you wonder slightly how fiscal levers work, but those are pretty well done. Quantitative easing, pretty well done. We're now talking about helicopter money, and anyone who's got a basic monetarist background like mine thinks that really is madness. Structural reform, incredibly important, central to countries moving on, but really hard. I mean, look at how hard it is to carry out structural reform in the Australian market. Trying to do that in countries like Indonesia, really tough. So after that, you move on to helicopter money in a more sensible form, and that is investment. And if you look at investment, then you want to be hitting as many growth and social targets with that investment as you can. And infrastructure is, I think, probably the best example of targeted investment, because you get the initial Keynesian bump of building the piece of infrastructure, and that's a country-based benefit. You get an increase in jobs and skills in operating it, so that's a long-term benefit. But then most importantly, if you choose the right infrastructure, you get that increase in productivity that allows you to be more competitive. And that's the key. If you're going to create virtuous cycles in countries which are sitting below the G20, that are trying to learn how to grow, then that virtuous cycle has to start with investment into infrastructure that creates more wealth than it takes to build. So if you look at a privately financed piece of infrastructure, you build it, you have a debt which you are going to service over the next 20 or 30 years. Forget the source of finance. Let's say you're just going to build it using your own resources. You still have that debt. That is an intergenerational debt you're creating, however you finance it. And unless you're selecting the right pieces of infrastructure that will create more wealth than that intergenerational debt, then you will never start getting onto the virtuous cycle where you create sufficient wealth to drag the poor into the middle class, increase things like health, increase education. These are the fundamental building blocks, and you have to get them right. So the G20 looked at this and said, what can we do? There's a ton of money wants projects. There's a ton of projects that need to be built, and the two just aren't meeting. Their premise was, if we had a bit of information flowing around the place a bit better, they'll all match up nicely together and it'll be fine. The reality is, that isn't going to happen because that's not the way it works. But the other reality is, if you have an impartial body sitting at the centre of the information flows that can ensure that the information going to countries is appropriate and unbiased, then you start to get to the point where countries who have to make big political decisions about this are at least well informed when they make those decisions. Sorry, that was incredibly wordy. Apologies.
No, also incredibly comprehensive. I suppose that, all right, so there is, but now in terms of the way that the hub's actually approaching this, it has taken quite a bit of time for the hub to be set up. And so the at least for a very impatient person, it has. At least also given It's under a four-year mandate.
Yes.
So I suppose one question will be, what are you doing in particular to promote the awareness of the work? And also, I think related to this is, what are the outcomes? Mm. We'd have a pretty big summit coming up in just a month in China. But we're actually only less than 12 months away from having a second leader summit, which the next one in Hamburg in Germany in July next year. So there's two very big pointers for the delivery of products, processes, reports, whatever you have, to actually promote infrastructure investment. Mm.
So let me try and shoot the slow off the ground fox. 2014 December was a decision was taken to set up the hub. I was recruited after a process that lasted 6 months and started then. We got our office built and staff starting roughly December, the end of 2015. So we've been running with staff now for 7 months. And in that period, we have created a knowledge portal, which allows for anybody who wants to go in to type in a country and a type of project. And it will then lead you through to standard models, tell you who's working in those countries, tell you what products they're doing, tell you which of the MDBs are operating there. So that's been set up, and that's now getting about 3,000 hits a month. And we're actually seeing quite interesting data coming from that, in that I thought people would be coming in looking for country-specific information. Nearly everyone comes in looking for standardized models. Everybody wants a standard starting point to go from. Mm. So really interesting. Yeah. We've just put out a tool looking at risk apportionment between the public and private sector. And that's now being translated into both Spanish and into Chinese to give it broader usage. So those are the first two products. But more importantly, we now have strategic products. So what's different about this moment in time than 5 years ago is the idea of disruption changing behaviours. And we see that everywhere, and everyone rolls their eyes a bit because disruption is now yesterday's word. But in my area, what are we trying to do? We're trying to get countries to improve both their knowledge of what they should do, but the performance of what they do, to make them better partners to the private sector. 20 people in Sydney are not going to make much of an impact on the hundreds of countries out there unless we get other factors to work for us. So the things that we're doing are, we're setting up, in effect, a rating tool. Sorry, if anyone's taking notes, could we not use rating in the notes? Mm-hmm. But because countries react very badly to rating. But in effect, we're looking at all the different factors that make a country effective as a partner to the private sector. Then we're measuring those, and we're going to publish them. And some countries will come to us and say, we really disagree that, you know, we have a very high corruption problem. Where did you get that from? And that allows you to start a detailed discussion with that country on an area that is directly the area we want to talk about. But also you'll have countries, maybe Indonesia and the Philippines, looking at each other and thinking, you know, do I agree with that? How do I feel about that? You'll have DFAT looking at this tool and saying, if I want to spend £1 Aussie dollar of my aid money, where shall I best spend it? And they will be able to see from independent sources each year which are the weaknesses that are preventing private sector and inward investment in the different areas. We will provide that framework year on year, so you see trends over time. But actually, the power of it are all of those bodies using it to decide what they're going to do in countries, and countries looking at it and thinking, if I put that right, I could change the way that I'm perceived as a destination of investment. So that's the first thing. The second thing in terms of big projects is the pipeline. And if I gave any of you a telephone and a bunch of contacts in 100 countries, you could come up with a pipeline over the next 3 weeks. It would be thousands of projects long. You have no idea which of those projects were real. You'd have no idea which of those projects it was worth backing. As a private sector entity, where do you start? So our pipeline is going to be a bit different. It will have those thousands of projects in the front. But as those projects move through the procurement process, they will move through a set of gateways, rather like the Australian or the UK gateway model. And so the private sector then have the ability to screen out any project that hasn't been through a gateway in the last 6 months, to only look at projects that have been through Gateway 4, to only look at projects that are using international consultants. We will put in a whole load of different bits of information which will allow the private sector to focus directly on the projects that are most likely to happen. And that's important. It's important for three reasons. The first is the governments will recognise what good behaviour looks like if they follow these gateways, if they use decent consultants to create good feasibility studies. They will attract attention, and they will see that attention in the number of people following their projects. So we end up using the private sector to drive better public sector behaviour. The private sector will have lower information barriers to entry. And that will make it easier for them to decide. They will see both the aspiration of the country in the front of the pipeline, but they'll actually see what's happening on the ground. They'll see the reality coming out over time. And for us, it will be a data-rich entity. It will tell us which countries can successfully procure their energy infrastructure but fail to procure transport infrastructure. We'll see which countries can get through the first four gateways okay, and then everyone just says, you know, this isn't going to happen, and walk away. We will see which of the MDBs are good at getting their projects over the line. We will see which countries put lots of projects in the front and none come out the back. This information, which will be freely available to all, will give a continuing growing picture of how the infrastructure markets work. And over time, countries will want that data to be positive about them, because that data will be, again, not for publication, their credit rating in the infrastructure market. And it will be that benefit. So we're looking at the market. We're looking at how do you get the private sector into the countries more easily? Let them know what's going on. Give them a single point of source. We're letting them know which of the projects are real. How do they work? And then we're providing them with specific tools to help make sure that when the negotiation starts, everyone understands exactly what they're supposed to be doing. So that's how we see ourselves running through this, and that's what we think the value add will be.
Very interesting. And you will also be working, I think, I'd imagine you'll need to be working quite closely with other kind of infrastructure and investment bodies out there, thinking the established multilateral banks like the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the newer banks like the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and the New Development Bank. Can I just get you to comment as to how you're approaching the relationships with these organisations?
We're in an interesting position, because as a single entity, we'll achieve nothing or very little on our own. So for us to be effective in creating the flow of bankable projects, we need to understand what are the big levers, what are the things that really work. And the biggest of the big levers, when you look at these emerging market countries trying to get infrastructure flowing, but in many countries as well, so throughout Europe, the EIB is powerful, are these multilateral development banks. They have people on the ground. They're a trusted partner in many of these countries. They have project preparation facilities, which are preparing projects and bringing them to market. They have risk guarantee products. They have first loss guarantee products. They have all of these different products which are aimed at opening markets. And yet when you look at the track record of the MDBs in bringing forward new projects, of involving the private sector, the track record is quite poor. So the hub has to walk a fine line. It has to both work with the MDBs to help prepare new products, to help make sure the products that we do prepare are being used. The risk matrix, we're working on using that with the World Bank and the AIDB. If they don't use it, nobody will. So it's important that we work with them collaboratively. But then on the other side, we also have to be a critical friend. We have to be willing to say if we think things need to change. And so we will be looking at the incentives on those MDBs to crowd in private finance. At the moment, the MDBs spend $35 billion a year in the infrastructure space. That is maybe sustainable if countries like Australia remain really, really generous, but actually it's getting harder and harder to sustain. And the majority of that money is spent paying for 100% of the piece of infrastructure they're building. The theory we're putting forward that we want to test is that actually they should be using that money, $1 of their money, $1 private sector, maybe $1 of their money, $5 private sector, who knows? But they should be opening up the markets for the private sector investors to go into it. Because those private sector investors are looking for product, they're looking for projects, they want to become involved, and many of them look at the MDBs as competition. That's really the existing MDBs. The new MDBs are a different and interesting challenge because the new MDBs, particularly the AIIB, which has 57 countries in it, including a very strong backing by Australia, the AIIB has been set up to change things. It's been set up to be different, to be more commercial, to be nimbler and quicker. The idea is you set up a new MDB, it doesn't have all the baggage of the past. It should be able to do things in a more modern and effective manner. And the AIIB, which has now been running for about a year and a half, has got a big challenge because it's got to prove, firstly, that it can create all of those substructures that make a bank work. And the best way to do that is to recruit people from other MDBs. They have the knowledge, the capability, etc. But they then have to springboard from that basic set of capabilities into being different. And being different means being more hard-edged, more commercial, thinking about how you want to improve those countries. By hard-edged and commercial, I'm not saying, you know, say goodbye to the harder, needy countries. I'm saying, look at those countries, think, how do I open those markets so that there is a broader array of players all helping? Because 100 billion sounds like a lot of money that the AIIB has to play with. It's nothing. We have a shortfall somewhere in the region of 1 billion, wrong, 1 trillion to 1.5 trillion a year between now and 2030. That's the shortfall after all the money is spent. 35 billion is nothing. We have to find a better widget. We have to find a better way of making these markets work. And the MDBs have to be part of the solution.
It's 1 trillion. There's always, infrastructure is always an impressive space for very large numbers.
Give me a number and I'll match it. It'll make it bigger.
Now, the hub was originally given a 4-year mandate. And so and this was back in 2014. So one always front of mind question whenever I've seen debate on the hub has been, what is the life of the hub after 2018?
It's an unusual position to take. You're looking at the longest term projects. You give an entity a target, which is to increase global growth through more fundable projects. And then you say, we'll give you 4 years to do it, including set up, get going, produce, prepare, deployment, impact. Again, not for publication. It's a bit of a nonsense. However, you go back to your point earlier, which is this was a really hard won entity from the G20. The only one they'd ever done before was the FSB in the face of the global crisis. The Aussies did a fabulous job in getting this up and running. And one of the things they gave to give it an initial life was that there would be a sunset clause of 4 years and that they would test whether they felt the entity had been a success after 3 years. And so we at the moment still have a 4-year life. And there are three possible outcomes at the end of, 3 years in effect. So by Christmas next year. The first is we're seen to be doing a good job. We are seen to be having an impact in the markets. The MDBs, countries, and the private sector all believe that we are a force for good. At that point, I think it'll be relatively straightforward for the hub to gain another 4-year life and to see how that works. And certainly, many of our present backers are coming to us and saying, we like the initial work that's coming out. We like the risk matrix. We like the portal. When are you going to come and talk to us? But we recognise that actually our original group of 8 backing countries isn't enough. It doesn't have Canada. It doesn't have the US. It doesn't have Japan. If we're to be seen to have been a success, those big countries that get infrastructure and want to be involved in infrastructure, we need to get them backing us. So what we will be doing is pushing forward with the work we're doing, ensuring that the work we're doing has relevance to the private sector as well as to the countries. And we will then be taking that as a packet of work to backers, both existing and future, and asking them to back us for another 4 years. If they say no, then either one of two things has happened. Either the stuff we've created is rubbish, in which case I pack up my bag and head off back to wherever else in humiliation. Or they say, actually, we think the stuff is good, but we don't think we need another entity to do this. We think this should sit in the AIIB, or it should sit in the OECD, or it should sit in the World Bank. And if that's their decision, then I would accept that, and I would then look to see how best to make sure that these products were fully understood and were given a life to continue onwards. I would say this, of course, so you can all zone out if you want to. I think that an independent body sitting looking at a complex industry like the infrastructure industry, which is so rife with both conflicts of interest but also corruption, having an independent body that has no axe to grind and answers to something like the G20, I think is a really good idea. And that's why I'm sitting here. And that's why I firmly believe that we'll get rolled over and given another 4 years.
And I'm keen to open this up for questions shortly, but I'll have one last stab. Yeah, one last stab. Because as you've, I think, just pointed out, the hub is, it's an experiment, but it's a very exciting one. And so what I'm interested in is, what lessons have you taken so far from the process?
I think that the first thing is, you can have brilliant ideas. You can have real enthusiasm from individuals who work in the space within a country. But the reality is, unless you can get the political backing at a high level within a country and an understanding of what it takes to make this market work, then you are going to struggle. And part of our remit is to have direct intervention in countries. And as we move forward with that, you know, we've now talked to 3 countries, all of them incredibly enthusiastic. We don't charge, so we're incredibly cheap. We have, I think, some very good ideas, and those ideas were enthusiastically received. We're taking ideas that have worked in other countries and helping countries do that. What's not to like? But the reality is that political inertia is an incredibly, I was going to say destructive thing, that's the wrong word, but it is an incredibly hard thing to overcome. And so gaining that buy-in at a high level with an understanding of what that buy-in means to the organs of government is a first step. And you look at the countries that have done this well, you look at the UK, where the Labour Party came in and just changed everything, and they went from 4 projects over 5 years to 1,000 projects over the next 5 years. You look at Canada, where the federal governments were basically told, it's this way or the highway, get on with it. Unless you have that real drive and understanding, it is incredibly hard to do. I think that's the biggest lesson. The second lesson I'd say is the generosity of the private sector and the generosity of civil servants who work in this area to give their time to try and help other countries move on. You can say it's self-interest if you like, but there are people and there are private sector entities out there who spend a lot of time with us, and they know there's not an immediate gain coming. They're doing it because they think it's the right thing to do. I think that's really inspiring.
Mm. Okay, well, thank you very much. That was very interesting, extremely broad-ranging, and I'm sure there are going to be people that are keen to ask some questions. So on that, some ground rules, actually, before. There's a microphone coming out around you, but so please keep these as questions, not remarks. And keep the question short, sharp, and please state your affiliation before asking.
My name's Mary. I'm from Charter Hall, so we're funds management property developers. Mm. I guess one area that I'm interested in is value capture. And so I guess, you know, you've spoken a lot about the public sector than private sector, but, you know, what are you doing to, I guess, have a look at the approach of governments towards, say, your residential landowners and conferring the message to them about the fact that any value uplift in their properties can be taxed in a, you know, under a value capture levy to, I guess, go towards the construction and maintenance of infrastructure through its life cycle.
So this is the issue of the moment, because we're all recognising that actually all of us sitting here only have a certain amount of wealth. Infrastructure is incredibly expensive, and when you see a windfall occurring because of infrastructure, how is that fair? So the conversations I've been having with government surround rationale, mechanism, outcome. Rationale, there is always concern amongst politicians. If I compulsorily purchase the land that I'm going to build on with too heavy a hand, it's going to be politically unpopular. If I attempt to tax in an aggressive manner, the uplift on people's personal property, it will be seen politically as a negative. And I'm encouraging them to swap that thinking round and say, how does the person whose tax dollar is being used to create this metro, this light rail scheme, how do they feel if their next door neighbour, who happens to be within the rezoned area around the station, gets a 4 times uplift on the property, the value of their property? That is their tax dollar creating a windfall gain to an individual for no other reason than, you know, fate has popped them on the spot. That's not a message, by the way, that's going down particularly easily, but it is an absolute, and at some point, people are going to start saying, excuse me, you know, we're paying a lot of money for this. How come we aren't capturing some of these windfall gains? So the second point is mechanics. The mechanics are all about set the rules of the game early, set the rules of the game wide. So in other words, you need government to be sitting there saying, from here on forward, you know, we will be rezoning around stations and we will be compulsorily purchasing the land within that rezoned area, and that is part of us building infrastructure. When you do that and set that early, you then of course need to have processes that keep or allow your purchase of land to precede the planning becoming aware. Because at the moment that somebody says, there's where the station's going, you've lost that value, because that value has passed effectively from you by making your intent clear to the individuals around that entity, because they now know what their value, the value of their property is, and they know it's much higher. So the second bit is intent. How do you go about doing it? How do you make it happen? The third thing is it worth the gain? Well, the MTR in China in Hong Kong is the gold exemplar of this, as are the motorways that were built, privately financed, from Hong Kong to Shenzhen 20-odd years ago. Those were entirely paid for by owning the land rights associated with those pieces of infrastructure. That's remarkable. The next best is a bit of a cheat, really, but 35% of Crossrail, which is a £40 billion, rather more than that now with where the pound is, it's a big bit of kit. 34 to 36% of that has been paid for by the uplift in property values. And actually, talking to the teams on that, there are 3 or 4 stations where they have totally lost that benefit because they failed to get the negotiation of the contract around the station done before they allowed the plans out. So they didn't get it all right either, but they've seen a massive uplift. The way they've done that is by effectively charging all businesses over a certain size in London, because this is a systemic piece of infrastructure to take weight off the whole structure. So they've done that. Beyond that, it gets tough. So you look at somewhere like Sydney, and you've got to say, what is the gross value of the land in Sydney? And Sydney is a typical more modern city. It is low density and very broad footprint. That makes things difficult, because low density means it's hard to justify mass transit and make it pay. And low density generally means that the value of the land per unit meter is lower than Hong Kong. So when you start looking at value capture in terms of Sydney's infrastructure, then I think it is an important element because of the equitable value, but I don't think it's going to pay for all the infrastructure.
Over here, and then...
I'll try and make the answers shorter, by the way, because I recognise that we're going to be caught otherwise.
And the question will be short as well. I'm from ASIC. I think what you're doing is extraordinary in terms of the transparency that it's creating and the tools and enabling us to move from talk to action. Just a couple of questions. The first is, can you talk to the challenges and the benefits of having this housed in Australia? Mm. And secondly, how are you going about publicising and marketing what you're doing? It's a great set of offerings, but I think it's important that, that both the private sector and the public sector throughout the globe, and particularly in our region, are aware of it. Thanks.
Challenge. Let me start with the challenge and get it out of the way. The challenge with being in Sydney is that, you know, it's a long way. If you're going, if your target is Argentina, and in 12 months' time it will be Argentina, then, you know, gosh, the air miles rack up. And my children think that I have a carbon footprint the size of God, and they don't say that is a good thing at all. So it's the travel issue. It is the only downside. What are the upsides? This is, to my mind, the home of privately financed infrastructure. So my first project ever of any scale was the Melbourne City Link, where we invested in that as a Welsh utility, and we created Transurban on the back of that. And in those days, the vision for Transurban was to be a broad-reaching infrastructure-owning entity. They were brave enough to put in place the first ever non-gated, non-cash payment collection system. They dammed up half of the Yarra to build a tunnel, then dammed up the other half to build the other half of the tunnel. It was utterly remarkable. And that set up the first of the listed infrastructure funds through the MIG, Macquarie Infrastructure Funds. And that led through to a number of rather painful projects, which I prefer to gloss over because I suffered on some of those. But that led through to a broad acceptance of pay-as-you-go and also a great understanding of where the private sector can bring benefit to bear. That is crucial. It's crucial that you are based somewhere where the world says they understand. That's point one. Point two is, when we launched the hub 8 months ago, I had Scott Morrison and Premier of New South Wales Baird. They're both standing there. They're both talking about infrastructure in a way which infrastructure professionals talk about infrastructure. I was talking about the problem of getting your politicians to understand it, to get what working with the private sector means. In this country, your politicians get it. Some of them don't like it. Some of them are against it. But they understand. They understand the strengths. They understand the weaknesses. They've got that background. I love going places and saying that we're based in Sydney. I love talking about asset recycling. So we've just done a piece of work for the Canadians where we're talking about asset recycling. Strengths, weaknesses. How does it work? Why is it interesting? What's new about it? What's not new about it? And that sort of conversation is much easier to have if you kind of come from the mother load. So I think those are the benefits. Trying to get the word out there is hard. And it's hard because if you're not getting the word out there, people think you're not doing anything. If you get the word out there too early, then people just get a bit peeved at seeing your face. So we spent a lot of time when we first set up talking to the private sector. And what we say, what we say is, if the private sector don't care about something we're doing, then we shouldn't be doing it. Because our aim is to get the private sector more engaged in this market. If they don't care, we should ask why we care. Back to the point, you can't keep on going back to them. At some point, we need to go to them and say, have a look at this lovely product. What do you think? And so the first elements of doing that with the risk matrix are ongoing. And so we're back into that engagement area. But it is a problem. We have a massive stakeholder group. Just the G20 is hard enough to cooperate and coordinate with, let alone the MDBs, let alone the banks, the lawyers, everyone else. If you've got any great ideas, then we're always very open.
All right, and over here, and then one down here as well.
Thank you. I'm Herma Putner from Ansdell. I have a question about how you take into account the influence countries gain from investing in infrastructure into other countries, like China, investing into high-risk countries like Nigeria, Afghanistan, etc.
Oh, gosh.
Small question.
So, there is a role for this type of soft power investing, if I were to put it that way. For some countries, it is really hard for them to get any infrastructure off the ground, let alone infrastructure that's really going to make a difference. So I'm not totally against the idea that China would invest in a country and take gains from it and have their contractors do the work. That's pretty much the only positive thing I'd say about it, because the negatives are all about transparency, corruption. What soft power gain is in play, and is it clearly understood, and is it clearly valued? Is the right infrastructure being built? If your junior despot decides that he wants to build a bridge to his personal mansion on an island, is that a good use of a country's mean resources? Well, we all know the answer to that is not. But just in case you think this is only a despot point, Spain built a new airport. They took the money from the EC to do it. It was going to be the third Madrid airport. And very sensibly, they built it next to a high-speed rail line next to a motorway. They did build it nearly 300 kilometres away from Madrid. They did forget to link into the high-speed line and didn't realise that actually putting a slow train onto a high-speed line didn't work. They never linked it to the motorway. It cost 1.4 billion euros to build. It operated for 6 months with Ryanair. Ryanair, I don't know if you know Ryanair. It raises a smile in the UK anyway. Even Ryanair decided it was a step too far. It was recently sold for 28 million euros. That is destruction of value. And anyone who thinks that doesn't matter because it's European money, that European money will be paid back by that region over time. That is the contrary to the positive cycle I talked about. So my concerns, lack of transparency, lack of control, lack of clarity over the projects that are being done, and in the end, the countries end up paying one way or another.
Right. And our last question.
Thank you very much, Chris. You do communicate so well. And my question is very simple. What is your website address, firstly? And secondly, which are the eight countries which are actually involved from
yes.
the G20?
Okay.
Thank you.
Laura, what is our website address?
It's www.globalinfrastructurehub.org.
It's a snappy title we came up with when we were brainstorming. So the countries that are involved are Australia, the UK, New Zealand, Mexico, Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, South Korea, China, Singapore. Indeed. And we are very grateful to all of them.
All right. I've just noticed we've got time for one more question, so if you'd like to ask. There's a microphone coming around.
Given the comments you were making earlier on about the issues of transparency and the need to invest in projects that deal with or deliver economic benefits and social benefits, is there much interest, either from the countries or private sector, to invest in a portfolio of smaller projects, often having higher BCRs in the big trophy project, or is there still this pursuit of the trophy project?
It's a great question. And the short answer is the trophy project is still massively influential in countries that really don't understand what they're doing. And they always have their project that they've been trying to do for the last 30 years. And all of a sudden somebody says, well, why don't you involve the private sector? And the private sector take one look and say, it didn't happen in the last 30 years. Why is it going to happen now? No good. There is, however, a greater willingness now to talk about planning. I mean, you guys are doing a fabulous job in this country in understanding the needs, working out what the strengths and weaknesses of those needs are, laying them all out. Doesn't happen in other countries like that. And when we look at infrastructure, we reckon that there's a hierarchy of how you should best spend your dollar. The first is, what's your existing infrastructure? Is it being used most efficiently? Most destructive possible cycle is build, neglect, rebuild, because that is incredibly expensive. And also the whole period where it's neglected, you're running at a disadvantage. So first thing you should be doing is making sure what you've got works. Second thing you should be doing is saying, all these networks out there, are there pinch points in the network where I can apply a small amount of spend to free up the capacity of a broad network? So that's number two. And then number three is increase capacity because we have to increase capacity. I mean, Sydney's fantastic example. You have brilliantly, with my help in some cases, buried an awful lot of your roads. You're now getting to the point where a lot of those roads are looking full. And so the options there are going to be work out how to use that asset more effectively or bury another road. And my goodness, burying another road is going to cost. So, you know, that's an example where I know there's a lot of work being done, thinking how to be more effective with an existing network. Some of the stuff we're doing, so countries are beginning to listen. We're working in Africa at the moment with the AFDB and the South Africans, looking at renewable energy sources. So putting the lights on in Africa was a US shout, which they're trying to push forward. The problem is, when these countries go out to try and put the lights on, it's a small country doing a small project, a renewable project or a gas project. It's very hard for them because they don't have that massive flow of projects to actually step into the place that Mexico got to with their recent reverse auction of solar panel, 3-4 cents megawatt hour, amazing. What we're doing is we're going to work with 10 to 12 of the small African countries. We're going to set up a totally standardized process, everything from the contracts through to the offtakes, so that as a group they can approach the markets and the markets will know what they are getting. It has a number of benefits. Firstly, it will drive down the pricing for these countries if it works, and they will end up getting their renewable energy more cheaply. Secondly, it is a sneaky way of enforcing standardization. And this might interest you guys, because I know you're looking at this as well. And by enforcing standardization, you create a pool of assets which begin to look awfully like an asset class. Once you can create a pool of assets, you can start going to the Macquaries, the Meridians, and those sort of players and saying, I know you don't like single point African risk. Here you have 12 countries. Here you have unified asset class, unified risk matrix, very, very similar contracts. I'm going to use a word which you'll all hate, let's go securitize these cash flows and take out this MDB debt, put it into the private sector and roll on to the next lot. So that's where small projects can be brought together, can be made bigger and can drive through to real benefits. And actually that matters to people on the ground.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
I think this has been an extremely broad-ranging conversation on infrastructure. Just looking at my notes, we're talking things from trophy projects to infrastructure as the good version of helicopter money to the AIIB, the World Bank and Multilateral Development Bank architecture to G20 mandates, dodgy projects in Spain, standardized projects, and all of the excellent work and the wide-ranging excellent work that the Hub has been doing and will be doing. I think it's genuinely an exciting experiment, and it will be well worth watching in the years ahead.
Thank you very much.
So please, everyone, join me thanking.